the headlines. President Raisi denounces attempts by Iran's enemies to blacklist the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, saying such moves are rooted in the IRGC's fight against terrorism. Muslim countries strongly condemn the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a Swedish-Danish right-wing extremist in Stockholm. And Burkina Faso calls for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country amid public anger at the French military presence. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Top Iranian officials have slammed the European Parliament for blacklisting the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. President Ebrahim Raisi says such moves are rooted in the IRGC's role against terrorists in the region. Raisi says enemies are trying to subject a large part of the ruling system in Iran to criticism due to its success, but will fail. He was referring to a Thursday resolution in which European lawmakers called for designation of the IRGC as a terror group. This comes as EU foreign ministers are set to discuss tightening sanctions on Iran next week. Iran's parliament speaker is now warning of immediate reciprocal steps if the EU sanctions on the IRGC or the IRGC blacklist is enforced. Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says Iran is ready to reciprocate against European armed forces. Earlier, political analyst Fuad Izzadi joined us with his take on the Islamophobia issue in Europe.
You know, normal people, when they fail at a project or a policy, they generally go back and try to make corrections, learn from the past mistakes, and have an action or a policy that is more reasonable. That's what normal people do, normal countries do that. And then you have some people occasionally that when they fail, they start swearing, they start chanting, stuff that is not appropriate. And the second category of people are generally they get upset because of the failure and they start saying nonsense. And it seems Europeans are in the second category, at least the people who voted for this motion are, instead of learning from past mistakes, instead of realizing that they cannot overthrow the Iranian government, they start name-calling, they start engaging in activities that are against international law, and they're going to hurt themselves. You know, they got into a fight with the Russian government, and they are not able to use Russian energy resources. If they want to repeat that with the Iranian government, they will be cut off from Middle Eastern energy resources, and that is not good for people in Europe.
Condemnations are pouring in from across the Muslim world following the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a right-wing Swedish-Danish politician in Stockholm. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the move is a clear example of spreading hatred and violence against Muslims. Nasser Kanani slammed the Swedish authorities for allowing the desecration of Islam's holy book. He said such sacrilegious acts cannot be justified under the false pretext of advocating freedom of speech. Turkey also slammed the vile attack on Islam's holy book in the strongest possible terms, saying a planned visit by the Swedish defense minister on the country has to be cancelled.
We have been following the process regarding this visit. As you are aware, we observed that there had been no reaction from the Swedish administration regarding those disgusting and mean actions against Turkey and our president. At this point, the visit of Swedish Defense Minister Pål Jonson to Turkey on January 27 has become meaningless and has no importance. That's why we cancelled the visit.
Meanwhile, Pakistan said the provocative Islamophobic act has hurt the feelings of Muslims around the world. Kuwait also dismissed the blasphemous move as a serious provocation, urging the international community to work towards stopping such moves. And Saudi Arabia called for dialogue, tolerance, and coexistence while rejecting hatred, and extremism. The United Arab Emirates said the profane move would undermine security and stability and was in violation of human values. Qatar, Jordan, and Egypt also condemned the move. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation slammed it as a provocative act insulting Islamic values. Our correspondent Rashan Saglam says Turkey has been one of the countries that have categorically condemned the burning of a copy of the Holy Quran by a right-wing Swedish-Danish politician outside the Turkish embassy in Stockholm.
Turkey considers the act of burning the Holy Quran as a vile act, and it says that going on with the demonstration, despite all warnings, was a completely unacceptable. The presidential spokesperson, Ibrahim Kalin, also tweeted about the issue, and he said that this is a hate crime, what happened in front of the Turkish embassy. He also said that despite all warnings, Sweden chose to give or allow this demonstration to happen, and he said this is encouraging hate crime, and this is encouraging Islamophobia. Turkey considers actually allowing this protest to happen, knowing that the Holy Quran will be burned. We know that the protesters, or the main character that initiated this hate crime, had tweeted several times that he is going to go with this act and burn the Holy Quran. So The Swedish government should have been aware that this is going to happen. Nevertheless, they still allowed the protests to take place.
Tens of thousands of Israelis have once again hit the streets to vent their anger at the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet. Israelis have been protesting against the Netanyahu regime for a third straight week. Protesters are expressing their disapproval of what they call a fascist cabinet and its proposed reforms meant to increase political power. Last week, an estimated 80,000 people descended on Tel Aviv to deplore the cabinet. Netanyahu returned to power at the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. Cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the rulings of the regime's apex court. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settlement units in the occupied West Bank. We have asked political commentator Paul LaRudy whether there is any difference between the current Israeli cabinet and the previous one.
What's happening is that the racist and fascist character of Israel is becoming stronger. And this is hardly avoidable, because a priority since the founding of Israel, in fact, when Israel was first in the imagination of Theodor Herzl, it was intended to be a racist Jewish state with the expulsion of the non-Jews from the area. Well, how do you bring about such a state if you don't have a highly racist political agenda and make it happen with the most extreme elements that will follow you? So this is the logical conclusion. It's going in that direction. The same thing is happening in the Ukraine, with Nazis in the Ukraine being showered with authority by the U.S.
Burkina Faso has called for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country. Burkina Faso's military rulers denounced an accord which allowed the presence of French armed forces since 2018, telling France to leave the country within a month. On Friday, people also thronged the streets of the capital to demand the French ambassador leave the country. Burkina Faso's former colonializer maintained some 400 special forces there under the pretext of protecting civilians from extremist militants. People, however, believe France has failed to properly tackle armed groups, and its military presence has even deteriorated the security situation in the country. High school students in the Italian capital, Rome, have held a rally against the country's school system. The demonstration was held on the first anniversary of the death of a school student who lost his life during an internship. Max Civilli reports.
Hundreds of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they call a school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
For a long time, our schools have abdicated their responsibility for a broad education, replacing it with convenience. Schools today churn out workers ready to join a labor market in which exploitation is the norm. In addition to that, educational standards are becoming increasingly poor.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European statistical agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
More classified documents are found in a family home of the U.S. president as part of a probe into Joe Biden's mishandling of sensitive government documents. Biden's lawyer says the documents were discovered during a search of his Delaware home this week. Biden voluntarily authorized the search. It came after two batches of classified files were found in the garage of his house and in a Washington office affiliated with him. They go back to when he was vice president and earlier when he was a senator. The president says that he has done nothing wrong and did not know about the files, but he is facing pressure and calls for a congressional investigation as he prepares for a possible rerun for presidency. In the United States, Joe Biden has now reached 2 years in office in his approval ratings. He has never been lower. First part of his term has been defined by constant crises, and many speculate that he will not be able to run for re-election. Ramin Mazahari reports.
United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right. They take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Peruvian police raided University of San Marcos in an attempt to expel the protesters who have been sleeping there. The protesters on Friday had stormed the campus, defying a state of emergency that now covers one-third of the country. The protesters are demanding the resignation of President Dina Boluarte and early elections. They are also calling for the release of former President Pedro Castillo, who is under arrest since December. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shimanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old, and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, January 22nd, 2023. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views and opinions are presented through your emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us, what do you think about IRIB English Radio programs? And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please don't go away and keep us company until the end of the program. Thank you. Welcome back. And here we've received reception reports from around the world, from Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Najmuddin from India, and Heikki Puranen from Finland. So, Mizanur Rahman, Najmuddin, and Heikki, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL from us. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world. For this program, I mentioned some of your names here, and later during the program, I will read them. For this program, we will read emails from Stu Forsyth from Malaysia. We've received an email from Anand Mohan Bain from India, one of our old and regular listeners. Yong Jean Lee from China has sent us an email. Najmuddin from India, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. And again from India, we've received an email from Jayanta Chakrabarty. Please stay with us. This is Listeners Special, and we've received many emails and letters from around the world. As I said, Stu Foritz from Malaysia has sent us an email. Let's see what Stu says. I am a New Zealander living in Malaysia with my wife. We are both teachers and have previously lived in Jordan, Dubai, and Vietnam. I think your service does a great job. It is really interesting hearing the news from a different point of view. Very refreshing. I very much enjoyed listening to the English broadcast. Very best wishes. Salam and warm greetings to you, Stu Foritz from Malaysia. Please accept our appreciations to you for sending us this email. And thank you very much for reflecting your views about IRIB English Radio and our programs, which you said you like the news section very much. So please accept our electronic QSL as verification and write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you. And from India, we've received an email from Anand Mohan Bain, one of our old and regular listeners. Anand Mohan Bain says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, greetings and Happy New Year 2023. I am Anand Mohan Bain, an old listener of yours. I regularly listen to the programs and send reception reports. For some time now, your program is not being heard online or is not available in the archive. I request you to take some action in this regard. The radio sometimes sounds good, but sometimes the reception is very bad. Salam and warm greetings to you, and thank you very much for letting us know your views about the quality of our programs. Anand Mohan Bain from India. We also wish you all the best in the new year 2023, and of course, greetings to you on this occasion. Of course, we will inform our technicians and engineers about the problem you mentioned. Anyway, write to us soon and let us know more about your views and opinions about IRIB English Radio broadcast. Anand Mohan Bain from India. And after a short break, I will be back with you with an email from China from Yong Zhong Li. Please stay with us. Welcome back. As I said, Yong Jung Lee from China has sent us an email. So let's see what he or she says. Dear sir or madam, hello, my name is Yong Jung Lee, a university student from Jiangsu province, China. Here is south of the lower branch of the Yangtze River, a region where fish and rice is in abundance. I am a shortwave radio enthusiast. I listen to your program recently and I do enjoy it. I thought that you may be interested in knowing that your program can be heard thousands of kilometers away. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Yong Jung Lee, thank you very much for your complimentary views on IRIB English radio programs. Yes, we are also very happy that our signals can be received kilometers away, especially in your region. You said Yangtze River, and you are a university student from Jiangsu province in China, so it's good to hear the news that the signals of IRIB English radio can be heard kilometers away, not only in your region, but around the world. Anyway, Yong Jun Li from China, write to us soon and tell us more about your experiences, your region you live, and of course, IRIB English radio programs. And we go to India again, where we've received an email from Najmuddin, one of our old and regular listeners. Najmuddin says, dear sir or madam, assalamu alaikum, please find the reception report enclosed to my email. I received your signals here in Murshidabad, West Bengal, India. Also, I am glad to say that news and news highlights program in your radio is always my favorite. Kindly send me a new program and frequency schedule printed QSL card with IRIB souvenirs. I will be very grateful if you kindly select me as a reception monitor to serve you as much as possible. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, from the capital city of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Najmuddin from India. Thank you. Thank you very much for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. Unfortunately, sending souvenirs is not possible at the time of pandemic, so please refer to our website to find the frequency schedule, and please accept our electronic QSL as verification. Najmuddin from India, many thanks for writing this email to your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. My colleagues will soon send you, as I said, electronic QSL as verification to this email. And we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. We wish you all the best. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special. And as for the last email in this edition of Listeners Special, we've received another email from India, this time from Jayanta Chakrabarty, one of our old and regular listeners. Jayanta Chakrabarty says, dear producer, I have been a long-time regular listener to IRIB English Radio broadcast. I'm interested to be an official monitor for IRIB English Radio for the new year 2023. I hope you will kindly consider my request. With warm regards, Jayanta Chakrabarty. Salam and warm greetings to you, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India. And please accept our warm gratitudes for sending this email to us. As for your request, I will, of course, inform my colleagues about this request. And please accept our electronic QSL as verification. We wish you all the best. Thank you very much for sending this email to your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, here we come to the end of our today's program. But before saying goodbye, I do send my warm gratitudes and appreciations to those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Najmuddin from India, Heikki Puranen from Finland, Jayanta Chakrabarty from India, also Yang Zhong Li from China, Stu Furitz from Malaysia, and Anand Mohan Bain from India. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with your listeners, especially and IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. God bless and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. is covertly sponsoring Daesh terrorists. That is a claim that Moscow has made when it comes to the Daesh in Afghanistan. But why would the U.S. do that? Russia says the U.S. wants to take revenge on the Taliban for its defeat. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether our guests agree on this stance by Russia. We will also take a look at other instances of U.S. support for Daesh terrorists and what gains the U.S. was looking for with this association, which, based on its track record, has not been anything substantial. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Daniel Kovalik, first over to you. So the U.S. reaching out to armed groups that oppose the Taliban and also secretly giving money to Daesh, that is what Russia's presidential envoy for Afghanistan has said. What do you think?
Well, I mean, why would anybody be surprised by this? The U.S., of course, was the one that supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, beginning actually in mid-1979, before the Soviet Union had a presence there. And, of course, the Mujahideen was a jihadist terrorist group. One of its leaders, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who went on to form al-Qaeda. So the U.S. has been working with terrorist groups, certainly as far back as the 80s. And since then, we know that the U.S. and NATO, you know, partnered with jihadists in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. They then helped those same jihadists in Libya to travel to Syria to try to overthrow Assad. And the U.S. supported jihadists in Syria against Assad. So this is really par for the course for the United States.
Okay, this is where, Frahius, we need to have you help us or help the ones who are not a believer of this or who do not accept this association between the U.S. and terrorist groups as to how that does happen. Because Daniel Kovalik talked about how it supported jihadists in Libya, then jihadists in Syria. His word was jihadists. We call them terrorists. As to how the U.S. Has done this and why it has done this and why did it resort to the terrorist formula as it saw?
Well, firstly, if you take a look at American history, I mean, America claims to have got its freedom from the British Empire in 1776. And then for 225 years out of 247 years of American modern history as an independent state, America has been at war with its neighbors or somewhere else within the globe. So American, not American people, but the American administration and the people behind these wars and the bankers for 225 years have been profiteering from war and profiting from the misery and the death and the maimings that they bring to other sovereign nations. I mean, you could even throw Ukraine into this. I mean, a lot of people believe it's a proxy war. The Americans are going to fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood in order to destabilize Russia. So if we take that as the most recent example and just move backwards, we can see that America uses proxy armies in order to carry out its dirty work when it's frightened to get its own boots on the ground. Indeed, there were instances in Syria where the Americans supposedly were dropping arms to their allies within Syria, which unfortunately and kind of uncontrollably fell into the path of Daesh. And the Syrian army has claimed before that their positions have been attacked by American forces prior to Daesh ISIS assaults on their positions. So, you know, there is a history of this. There is a history of the proxy wars where the American administration uses other people to carry out their fights. And one other example would be when America and its allies invaded Iraq. It was about 6 months after the invasion of Iraq that we began to witness the bombings of the various mosques. Now, to my mind, that was used by America and especially Britain in order to sow division and civil war within Iraq. While Iraqis were fighting each other, they were not fighting the occupation. Sure. And I think America wants to see Afghanistan to continue to be disabled because it's on the borders with Iran. And you never know who they could try and bring to power as a pro-Western puppet regime in the future.
Yeah, we're going to discuss some of those examples in greater detail and maybe even more examples of this U.S. Association with these terrorists in one form or another. Going back to what the Russian envoy has said, and this is pretty interesting, Daniel Kovalik, he has said the Americans have been acting this way, quote, because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation they do everything so that peace is not established in this troubled land. Now, I'm curious as to how this can be understood. I mean, it wasn't bad enough that they occupied the land for over 20 years. It wasn't bad enough that nothing that they promised really panned out. But now that they have pulled out and left the country in tatters, they wanted to destroy it more by supporting this group. I mean, are they supporting then by default these terrorists that are bombing instances where we know that it has led to many civilian deaths?
Well, yes, I think that is probably the case. And again, this seems to be the current modus operandi of the United States in its foreign policy, particularly in West Asia. When you look at the wreckage that the U.S. and NATO have left behind in a place like Libya, which was a very stable country under Gaddafi, very prosperous. Of course, the U.S. and NATO bombed that country to smithereens, left it broken. Now there's slaves being sold in public markets. Libya may never be restored to a stable country. The same can be said of Iraq. The same can be said of Afghanistan itself. It seems that actually destruction is the goal many times. And why would that be? I don't think it's purely out of spite, though in the case of Afghanistan, there was probably some of that. But it's because the U.S. has decided that it's easier to rule and to exploit other people's resources and labor if there's no unified, stable state that governs, right? I think another example of this is the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the U.S. has supported proxies as well for many years, which have gone in and killed literally millions of Congolese, but again, to maintain instability in that country so that the West can just plunder the resources there without limit, without having to pay taxes. I think that's what we're seeing. That is U.S. foreign policy.
In the case of Afghanistan, however, just as a segue here, that, I'm sorry, Fra Hughes, it appears that the U.S. would have a lot to actually benefit when it has an unstable Afghanistan, given the fact that you have this Russian envoy stating what it has in terms of the U.S. terrorist connection, because you have, on the one hand, Iran on the one side, and then you have China. You have also Russia, in a sense, where the Russian envoy has actually blamed the U.S. also for wanting to support this because it wants to go after Russia. So the U.S. Can benefit from this association when it comes to three of its, whatever you want to call them, arch foes or what have you. In this case, in point, Afghanistan's destabilization through these Daesh terrorists can be a way for the U.S. to get to these countries. Is that one or a correct way of looking at this?
I'm not sure. I would say that there's definitely possibilities for further destabilization of Iran, depending on what parts of the country Daesh in Afghanistan could possibly control with the armaments and the finances coming through from America. But, I mean, America claimed it attacked Afghanistan because of 9/11, but when they put in their puppet president, Mohammad Karzai, at the very beginning, the first actual kind of presidential decree he signed, I believe, was an order to allow a gas pipeline to travel through Afghanistan that may have been previously banned or not the case under a previous regime. I agree. I don't think it's about revenge. America cares nothing about Afghanistan or the Afghan people. I believe when they pulled out, they were purely pivoting towards China. So they've withdrawn their forces in Afghanistan in order to regroup both for Ukraine and for any forthcoming kind of action against or to China. So I think that's why they left. I mean, America could have stayed on in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban had the countryside, but the Allies and the Americans had the cities. So they could have just stayed in perpetuity with a low-level war in order to plunder the resources of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But I think they have, you know, they have their chess pieces on the global board. And if we look even further back, you know, when America was focused on Latin America, we had dictatorship and people that were supported brutal dictatorships, brutal right-wing fascist regimes that tortured and murdered and disappeared their own citizens. That was all with the backing of America. So America, as it changes its foreign policy, following its, you know, its eye on where it's looking to exploit next, then that's why we have seen the war in Ukraine, the wars in West Asia, and potential wars going forward with a potential proxy with Taiwan and Japan against China. So it's a very dangerous, very sinister campaign that that the American administration is following.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, and Danny Kovalik, when we first started out, you talked about the statements made by the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in terms of the Mujahideen, I think is what you said. And interestingly, in some sense, back in 2014, the former U.S. President Barack Obama hosted a two-day strategy meeting. I'm looking at this one particular case in point, where he met with the intelligence chiefs of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, and some of them as Middle Eastern countries. And what the purpose of that meeting was, this two-day security meeting, was to refocus military aid away from the al-Nusra Front and, well, they call it ISIS, we call them Daesh, towards more moderate groups of what they called rebels. So when you take a look at the type of involvement with these terrorist groups through its allies, okay, we're seeing an extensive penetration that they had, not penetration, connection that they had with these groups in a variety of levels and based on a variety of different terrorist groups. And, of course, that was 9 years ago, back in 2014. These types of relationships have been going on for quite some time, right?
Well, yeah, and I believe it was in 2014 that Joseph Biden, then vice president, said that there were no moderate rebels in Syria, and that therefore the rebels we were supporting were not moderate, meaning they were in fact the very terrorists we claimed we were fighting against. In fact, that could be said about the Free Syrian Army, which the U.S. openly supported for a time, and which committed terrorist acts in Syria, including trying to destroy Christian churches in cities like Malula and Homs and elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, we know for sure that the support for those types of groups goes back that far and even farther. You know, Seymour Hersh, who won the Pulitzer Prize, a great Western journalist, he wrote an article back in, I want to say, 2007, maybe, saying that even by like 2005, George W. Bush had pivoted away from fighting terrorism to actually at times partnering with terrorists to try to weaken Syria, weaken Iran. And let's remember, the U.S. Has supported the MEK over time, the MEK being a terrorist group that's killed tens of thousands of Iranian civilians. So, again, nothing is surprising about this. This is par for the course. The sad part is that few Americans realize it, but the truth is out there. And again, there's many officials in the U.S. government who at times have admitted this.
Sad part, I think, sadder even than that, is the fact that we here in the Islamic Republic are being labeled as terrorists. Not we, but the government. That's a whole other topic for another Spotlight program. Okay, so the U.S., Farah Hughes, has a base in Syria. Not far from it, there are terrorists that are there. And for years now, even though it's illegally occupying that part of Syrian territory, it's been saying that it's there to eradicate terrorists. Why doesn't it get rid of the terrorists there? Why is it that, for example, Russia has said that the Al-Tanf military base, terrorists are roaming freely around in that area, and also has accused the U.S. of training some of these terrorists? What do you think of those statements from Russia?
Firstly, I'd have to say I've always been very impressed by the spokespeople that the Russian government has fronting their foreign policy. They seem to be people of integrity, people of honor, and people of honesty, and who refreshingly appear to tell the truth and paint the picture as it's seen on the ground in Syria and Ukraine and Afghanistan and anywhere they choose to see what's happening under kind of Western imperialism. I believe fully that America will be training the Daesh terrorists in Syria. They're still there stealing the wheat of the Syrian people. They're still there stealing the oil. So we're back to the wars for profit that continually seems to be the background to these conflicts. I would fully believe that America is not only training and arming and financing Daesh in Syria, but I would be fairly convinced that they are directing them. The only ointment in the eye here at the moment appears to be Turkey's growing fraternal relationship with Syria and Russia, and it's distancing itself from America, and perhaps it's going to join the new kind of Belt and Road initiative, the new Silk Road, to bring more prosperity and more jobs to Turkey. So I believe the Russians, and I would believe them a lot sooner than I would ever believe one word of a British, European, or American politician or spokesperson.
Let's go back to the year 2012. I know it's a long time ago, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm wondering if you remember this. This was a case that went to trial in London of a Swedish man that was accused of terrorism in Syria. Again, I don't know if you recall that. And you have this man being tried in court, and then all of a sudden, it's not all of a sudden, but then it became clear that the courts were not aware that British intelligence had actually been arming the terrorists that that defendant was charged with. I don't know if you remember that. It was quite a case where later on, based on a particular source, reports were cited that MI6 had cooperated with the CIA on a rat line, as it was called, of arms transfers from Libyan stockpiles to the Syrian terrorists. So that's a clear case in point of how you have different intels of the countries, in this case the U.S. and the U.K., cooperating together to arm terrorists. I know this is, again, old news, but don't you think this serves as a clear case in point of U.S. and, of course, the U.K. Support behind terrorists?
Well, yes, and I don't remember that particular case, but what I do remember is, again, another Seymour Hersh article called Red Lines and Rat Lines about the very phenomenon you were talking about the U.K. and the U.S. Supporting terrorists in Syria. And by the way, Seymour Hersh really, after writing that, had a hard time getting published anywhere because no one in the West wanted to hear the truth about that. The other thing in 2012 was that the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, I believe, they had a classified document that somehow was leaked that, again, admitted that the U.S. was supporting groups in Syria whose intentions were to set up a caliphate in Syria. And so, again, all these things are pretty evident that the U.S. has been secretly supporting these groups for many years.
The question that comes to mind here, it's a very simple question, Frau Hughes, and forgive me if I'm asking this, but why does the U.S. have to subscribe to terrorists? Why doesn't it just go after who it wants to go after, which it does, through its own army? Is it that incapable that it has to subscribe to terrorists?
I think it's possibly cheaper to use someone else. If you remember the Vietnam War with so many American casualties that the American people eventually turned against the administration and demanded that their troops be brought home, that hasn't happened in recent conflicts because we saw shock and awe. What you've actually seen is the America as the number one superpower, having such a tactical advantage on the rest of the world. I mean, attacking Afghanistan and attacking Iraq and Libya and Syria, these are countries that could not possibly militarily stand up to America. But I do believe it's easier to try and install a proxy government. It's easier to pay other people to do the dirty work and do the fighting. And rather than put a huge amount of American boots on the ground and therefore kind of exposing them to potential attack by, a revolutionary army of national liberation. I mean, when you create Daesh, I believe America created that with Saudi Arabia. So it was, Saudi tech fury, fanatical, kind of fundamentalist Islamists who are following the wrong path in Islam by following the route of terrorism. I mean, they were financed by Saudi Arabia and they were backed by America. And Turkey allowed them to enter into Syria. So there's a little triumvirate there that allowed this war on Syria to take place. So it's easy for the American Congress to vote, you know, to give money to the military budget, and then the black hole that appears in the CIA accountability of those finances and the Pentagon and stuff, that they can just run off, buy arms, buy weapons, buy mercenaries, because that's what Daesh is. It's a mercenary army paid for by America and Saudi Arabia. And when you think of the likes of the White Helmets, they were the kind of propaganda wing for Daesh in Syria. I mean, they were started by an ex-MI6 operative, and they were backed by millions of dollars from Britain and from Canada and from America in order to promote the propaganda that they were using around chemical warfare and the barrel bombs that were just supposed to destroy hospitals in Syria. So, you know, if I had the money, I wouldn't go and fight my enemy. I'd probably pay someone else to do it and keep myself safe.
Okay, so the final question goes to you, Daniel Kovalik. Iran has always said that, you know, when you have the foreign countries and their armies in one form or another in this particular region of West Asia, and this is in direct reference to the U.S., that you're going to have these types of activities still prosper in some sense, or still to ongo, to continue, that is. And of course, the association that we have made in this program of the U.S. with the Daesh terrorists is still one source of instability, which Iran says that the U.S. needs to go. Are we looking at the fact that if the U.S. was to leave the region, that these terrorists would cease to exist?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the sad part, the sad truth is that once you create such monsters, they tend to have a life of their own. We saw that, again, with the Mujahideen, which morphed into Al-Qaeda, which then went on to attack the United States. I don't think that was the plan. I mean, there's a lot of unintended consequences from all this. Now, you'd hope that eventually those things would fizzle out. But again, you know, the U.S. has created monsters that it's set loose on the world. And once that happens, it may be hard to control and stop them. And that, again, that is one of the great tragedies of all this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Farah Hughes, thank you. Journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.